happening now. We want to welcome our viewers from across the United States and around the world. This is the EdTech Situation Room. Good morning, good day, good evening. This is EdTech Situation Room, episode number 311. That is a lot of episodes. It's November 29th, 2023. My name is Jason Neifer. I'm the executive director of the Montana Digital Academy, which is the state virtual school located on the beautiful University of Montana campus right here in Missoula, Montana. And joining me tonight, as always, good evening, Dr. Wes Fryer. For a variety of reasons, it's good to see you, but it's my understanding you had perhaps a fender bender recently that you walked completely away from. And I just want to tell you how thankful I am personally for that. But good evening to you, sir.
Yes, indeed. I am thankful to be here in one piece. And it was actually a week ago today. It was Wednesday right before Thanksgiving. So, yes, we have a... We're car shopping. We'll say that. So, and thankful to have not been, you know, in the hospital. So I'm Wes Fryer. I am a middle school media literacy and STEM teacher here in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I do not feel like I am tricking you with the seasons with, you know, we got the fireplace here. We got the snow over here. It was actually 22 degrees this morning, which is the coldest we've had. Normally we don't really get that cold. So
yeah, it's pretty chilly.
Yeah. But it feels like winter. I think it's gonna be December soon. And I've been counting the days, and this isn't total number of class days because we have to proctor some exams and things, but I basically think six more classes before the break. And then our kids kind of have a week of finals and stuff. So
wow.
Excited to be here with you, Dr. Neifer. I know we've had to alter our schedules a little bit, so we're kind of skipping. And we are going to have the podcast, by the way, come back on the website. I have been taking care of a few different things, and thankfully YouTube and Facebook immediately archive us, but and the links are obviously still there. But what is you're still pretty much human most of the time. Is AI, do you feel like the Bionic Man? Are you becoming I don't remember what that guy's name was, but we used to actually watch that show.
Yeah, it was Lee Majors, is that right?
Yeah, very good.
Yeah. Ooh, yeah, good yeah, yeah. So I good sadly I am full of bad popular culture history, but yeah, I mean, what I would say is that, and obviously we're going to talk about AI a boatload tonight. It is wild to be. I don't know. I kind of feel like that folks like Dr. Fryer and myself are kind of on the front row of this, right? We're keeping a close eye on this. We've obviously, been techie teachers for, the vast majority of our careers. And so we're keeping a close eye on this. But just watching the drama that goes along with all of this stuff right now, I think it's both pretty wild and kind of exhausting, actually. And I had to do double Thanksgiving this year because my parents and my in-laws were in separate locations for a variety of family reasons. And so I had two Thanksgiving dinners, and 48 hours of that was completely off the grid deep in a coulee in north central Montana that has no internet access. And so that was actually a blessing. And I felt very fortunate that I could leave the grid for 48 hours and read a fiction book that had nothing to do with the future of artificial intelligence. So that was nice as well. But watching the drama over the last couple of weeks, and I will also say too, having spoken to I've got to be at 25, maybe 30, either discussions or presentations on this topic. Last night it was with a group of pre-service teachers in a social studies methods course. Those are, awesome, students that are looking to take on a challenging subject area and a challenging time in teaching. And, my hat absolutely goes off to them, but kind of talking through last night what we think is legitimate, what we don't think is legitimate, where those lines are at. I do think that there's a lot of interesting discussions to come. Is what I would say about my variability in regards to my own humanness.
Well, and as another sign of those times, as I'm looking at our links, we literally have no other categories tonight besides AI. So I will throw maybe a few things in, but usually we've got some some Googles and some Apples, and I'll throw in. I don't know if you saw the Apple ad that came out in just like a week ago, but yeah, it's what are we gonna do? Because as I'm staring here, There is no escaping AI tonight, Dr. Nyberg.
Yeah, there
no,
really is.
We have no choice.
Well, let's start here. There were some really incredible things announced a couple weeks back at OpenAI's conference, and we scratched the surface of them 2 weeks ago. But I guess before we jump into the more on the ground things with OpenAI, obviously the big drama has been the firing and rehiring of Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, and there's been so much, you know, oxygen sucked from the debate on AI because of this. And maybe it was financial, maybe there was some sort of super technology that was developed. The board, who is made up of folks that are, for probably a lack of a better way of putting it, a bit cynical about artificial intelligence, or at least are safety-minded about artificial intelligence. Perhaps that led to him leading from the board. Of course, Microsoft tried to hire up Mr. Altman and those OpenAI employees that also quit in the face of his own firing. And, you know, there's a lot of pieces here, and we may not know the full story or exactly what the dynamics are or were until well down the road when the story gets told in more of a historical perspective. But obviously a lot of upheaval in the last a few weeks with that. And what's also entertaining is that this happens at the precipice of the 1 year anniversary of the release of ChatGPT, which was this week.
Was it really?
A year ago. Wow. Yeah. Wow. And Wes, I should go back and look. I don't know if we talked about it in the early days of it last November and December, but I was pretty blown away by the tech a year ago. And that feels a very long time ago now. But even, there are other competitors in the space, and obviously there are new models that have been, released. The bottom line is that OpenAI seems to be, if not in the lead, at least in front of the pack of the groups in the lead, and, you know, pretty interesting stuff, all part of this process.
Well, and I think you and I, and thanks to you, learned about Claude, started exploring, and I've done a fair bit with Bard as well as Claude. Are there any others that you would put up there in that category with ChatGPT? Because I've really enjoyed Bard and the functionality that it has had about uploading direct files.
Yeah,
I don't know if you've run into this.
Claude or Bard?
Claude with the attachments.
But
so, Bard has been like handicapped, because a few weeks ago I was able with Bard to put in direct links to publicly shared documents and have it analyze, and it helped me like look at some server log files and things. And when I tried that, I think last week, it wouldn't do it. And I said, wait a minute, are you telling me you've been crippled with, you know, additional guardrails that says, well, I'm being development and da, da, da. And so anyway, we'll throw around this like, oh, this is the worst AI that we'll use. But interestingly, and this is just my own guessing based on my experiments, it seems like the guardrail and limitation aspects of this are still very much in flux. And so some of the kind of basic kinds of functions, right? Like, because being able to put a public link to a Google Doc and then have Bard analyze it, like that's a tremendous capability instead of having a text limit of being able to paste it. So anyway, it just seems like things are in flux. Would you put anything with ChatGPT, Bard, and Claude in terms of top level tools?
Well, I'm actually going to refer to Ethan Mullock here, the professor from the Wharton School that is, I guess, for lack of a better way, is really the clarion voice, I think, for AI in education. He put up a post yesterday celebrating the 1 year release of ChatGPT, and here's where he's at on it. If you compare ChatGPT 3.5, so that's the year-old model, right? It's also the free model if you're not paying for the advanced 4.0 model. Oh, here's what his assessment is. He said that Google Bard and Palm 2 is worse than ChatGPT 3.5. He says Amazon Q, which was just released this week, that's their large language model, that was, I think, released on Monday. He said it seems similar to ChatGPT 3.5. He said X's Grok, that is the play for Elon Musk in the models. He says it's similar to 3.5. He said Llama 2, which is Meta's model, is similar. And he says Apple has nothing released, so they're not really comparable. And he said the two smaller labs, and I guess I never thought of Anthropic as a smaller lab, but I think it probably is, actually, based on his expertise. He said that they're smaller models, but they seem somewhere between 3.5 and 4.0. And so the fact that, you know, the best anyone has been able to do is catch up with the year-old ChatGPT 3.5 model is a sense that they are really the market leaders. And he does mention in his post that Google's Gemini model, which is supposed to get wider adoption with specific tool sets, should be coming out soon and could come close to GPT-4. But that's where he's at right now on it.
Was that the not much is changing, a lot is changing November 20th post? Or which
no, this is the November 28th post 1 year since. And here I'll put
that. I don't know. Is that on One Useful Thing?
I should say that's on LinkedIn, actually.
Oh, okay, great. You know, it's amazing to me that this technology, so many different things, but when have we ever had a technology where the companies are really reticent to just push forward as fast as they can because of the danger of releasing something that is too powerful, doesn't have guardrails, is going to blow up in their face because people are going to do things with it that, you know, are harmful or just create bad media and bad press. I'm reminded of the Apple G4 when, you know, it was categorized as a weapon. And so export outside the United States to different places was prohibited. And that was hardware. It just, somebody had mentioned to me yesterday, and I hadn't heard that, but you said there was rumors that perhaps OpenAI has cracked some kind of super intelligence and vast power, and that the board of OpenAI was concerned about that and trying to slow things down. I mean, it's so fast. And thank goodness we can sit around and talk about it. Maybe I'm sounding nonsensical right now, but I'll tell you, ladies and gentlemen, the chance to be able, even if it's every other week, the chance to be able to, you know, talk about these things, get some updates, reflect on them, because this is one way we deal with change, right? We process it, you know, and if Jason and I could go grab a coffee or a beer or something like that, we'd do it. We just, how many thousands of miles do we live apart, you know?
Yeah.
But hey, it's good. Hey, and we've got a live viewer on there today, so welcome to the show. How are you dealing with that, by the way? How you mentioned, it sounds like you're getting fatigued. How are you dealing with AI change fatigue? Is that a real thing for you?
Well, it really is. And part of it is that this is where I very, very feel like this. I do feel like that, you know, I have organizational responsibilities. Yes, some of that is AI leadership because we're dealing with the, you know, how learning models might be impacted just like any other organization is. But, you know, as an example of this, I found out recently, and I've had zero time to experiment with it, is that, and there's an article that I'd like to talk about a little bit later, but you can download models from Hugging Face, which is one of the kind of developer focused AI sites, and you can run them locally using something called LM Studio, which means you could basically download a model and run it offline on your laptop or desktop computer. And including a number of uncensored models. And that idea is very interesting to me because as we put in all of these you know, guardrails into AI to make it more safe, some people would argue that it also makes the tools less functional. And that's the article we can talk about here in a few moments. But I would love the time to experiment with these, but I certainly can't justify spending time during the day doing it. And I'm a 50-year-old guy now, so I need my 8 hours of sleep. And I'm a big proponent of work-life balance, which is a relatively new phenomenon for me. And even though it's interesting, I just can't spend all weekend, you know, buried in my basement playing with uncensored large language models.
Are you all doing that play date? You had talked about doing something around AI.
We are. Yep. In fact, we had another meeting about it yesterday. We're going to try to do maybe a couple of them in the springtime. And I think that whole notion of having people in a room, it helps so much that, you know, as a University of Montana employee, I have access to space that would be difficult to have otherwise. Yeah, we're definitely going to head in that direction. And, you know, I think that that is very tempting for me, if for no other reason, just to sit next to other people that are playing with these tools as well.
I don't know if you remember that, you know, as ed camps were really going popular, I know that Scott McCloud was involved, but others in Iowa, they had like 5 simultaneous ed camps and then some kind of synergy around them. I'm very encouraged by the fact that you're going to do this play date, which is sort of ed campy, yeah. But it's different. But man, I think that is, in addition to being able to sit down, you know, every week or so and talk about those things, I think that is a very concrete and positive thing that we could each do, is to find a chance to play with these tools together with others and have that be a catalyst for doing that, you know, because we're all busy, there's all kinds of stuff going on, but I will say that I was able to share a little bit with one of our middle school art teachers. We had student-directed conferences a couple weeks ago, and it was like right before Thanksgiving. And so anyway, we were just, you know, together, and it was this situation where we just happened to be around and we're waiting. And I said, oh, here, let me show you this, because I've wanted to show him some stuff. And it just blew his mind, and he's so excited. And those kinds of moments where you're able to help bring awareness of another capability, another tool. He's used ChatGPT. There's, you know, teachers, I think, realize like writing comments, writing letters, you know, text, but he had not seen the visuals. And as an art teacher, he's frequently asking his kids to Google things to help with inspiration, you know, whether it's a watercolor or a oil painting or whatever they're doing. And so, you know, this idea that you can now just, you know, type the words and see them. And it doesn't seem cartoonish. You know, the tool that was plugged in a year ago when this came out to Padlet really created some pretty rudimentary looking images. I was deterred by Midjourney because I'm not what's the platform you have to use to do that?
Discord.
You have to be a Discord user. And it was like code. It was code. It is code. I mean, unless you change it. You have to know the code and where to go. Yeah. And I tried a little bit, but it was like, it was a little bit too high of a bar for me. Now with ChatGPT-4 with built-in Dolly, I mean, it's just stunning. So anyway, I appreciate, your leadership, and I will look forward to hearing about that. I've also toyed with the idea of maybe doing an online version where we just on a Saturday morning, or, you know, kind of like the what was that called? Web 2.0. It was on Ning, Steve Hargadon, Peggy George. Classroom 2.0 Live. Classroom 2.0 Live was just so wonderful. West. I know, we're just so old. And then we forget things. We're seriously, folks, like, enjoy our voices now, because in a couple years, what did you say? I couldn't hear that. We're all just, everything is going to sound like that. But by then, we'll have AI that'll help us. So we're not even going to look this way. Anyway, let's think about that idea, because I think that would be fun too, even if it was, you know, just an hour. You know, I had a Zoom call with our daughter earlier this week, and she went back for Thanksgiving. And this is amazing to me. Like, being able to do this, hey, we're just going to sit down and visit. So playing with AI tools. I'm excited you all are doing those play dates in person, and I think it's a fantastic concrete idea. And it's a great way also just to bring people together, right? What a great way to bring people into your college of education, into your university, and then get people to collaborate. And this is that is one of the most important things. I don't know if you saw, there's a video that, I wrote a blog post about it. He's a historian. He's Jewish. Yuval Noah Harari. I don't know if you've read his stuff, but he has a pretty good video about the return of wars, and it's a political science thing. But he talks about collaboration, and he says, this is what we need to lean into. One of the main reasons we as a species have done well is because we've been able to collaborate and work together. Anyway, that was a reminder of that. So a small thing to get together and play with media and play with AI, but I think some really great conversations can come from it. So keep that up.
And I would also say, too, the other thing I really like about that model is that I will not say that workshops aren't an effective model, because they absolutely are. But you get to a certain point, especially when you are maybe an advanced user, that it's hard to find professional development that really speaks to your level, where you don't become kind of the de facto teacher in your part of the room, right? And that's where I'm most excited, is that, I mean, certainly there is untapped capacity in someone that would come in on a Saturday and hang out for a tech play date. I'd love to find those people, both because I think it could be an extraordinary opportunity to find, additional advocates in the space, but also then I learn stuff too. And part of what, the best 60 minutes of professional development I get every week is talking to Dr. Fryer here. But the bottom line is that experience, I think, is just as important.
Well, maybe we could even look at our schedules. I don't know if you'd be open to doing an online one, but if we could maybe do a Saturday morning or something, or maybe I'll put a poll out there or something. I think that'd be great, because I want to do the same thing in January or February, and I think I'll have some time to get that ball rolling. So it's where sometimes these conversations lead to good that's why our conversations are the reason I discovered Claude and, created book summaries for the Sunday school class we're in. And just, I've had a chance to face to face show other people how to do that, blow some people's minds, and also just create a great resource that we wouldn't have had otherwise, that helped people who either didn't read the chapter, or even if you did, here's the vocabulary, here's the main points, here's discussion questions. It's phenomenal. Okay, I actually have an article, and this is one I just did drop in, so it's towards the bottom. This is from the Washington Post, and so here's a gift link. And the headline is, Sports Illustrated's use of AI infuriates a staff already in turmoil. And so, as predicted, we have different journalism. Journalism has been in crisis, and there's all kinds of things going on in the world of journalism. But it's been predicted AI is going to take jobs, and there's going to be companies and folks that are going to turn to these AI tools instead of human beings. So there's this third party company, and this I guess was originally reported by Futurism, that fake writers have been utilized to write these articles, and they had this big meeting with all the staff, and it was really heated, and they didn't really feel much better after the meeting. And evidently leadership said, no, we just created these fake pictures and fake names, but really this company we hired wrote the articles. But the website of the company brags that they use AI to be much more efficient. And so, it appears that AI has been writing these articles. So, anyway, I don't know. Those kinds of articles are probably, there's probably categories, and you probably have seen those. I don't know how you would categorize the different, and there's the sky is falling and jobs are going to be gone, and the world is going to be dystopian and terrible. And maybe this sort of fits into some of those categories because people are expecting that. But anyway, I thought this was a notable Washington Post article.
It very much is. And I read that article, Wes, when I saw you post it somewhere, not on Twitter, but so I guess to start with, I do think that a lot of otherwise uninteresting, uncreative writing is going to be replaced by artificial intelligence. That's almost a certainty to me. And particularly as it relates to, and I didn't get a sense of the actual content of the articles, but we're just talking
about... They were
about
reviews. They were product reviews. So they were saying they weren't, covering a sports team. It was a SI product review.
Okay. Well, that's even weirder, actually. But I don't think that there's clearly, I think, room or necessity for human journalism, human sports journalism, when it comes to writing more colorful descriptions, more narrative descriptions of a game. But if you're just talking about a recap of a box score, I mean, that's actually been automated for some time now, right? And a lot of organizations have utilized, early days artificial intelligence to write those stories. But I guess I'd go back to, you know, that's, it's so interesting to me because, you know, there is a lot of question about where journalism is going and the industry itself and the complications behind that and yada, yada, yada. But what I think is particularly interesting about that for me is that, you know, sports is what keeps a lot of local papers running, right? That, sports coverage, is what tends to get a lot of attention from local readers. And, you know, I do think that journalism is absolutely impacted by artificial intelligence. And I think that we're just beginning to get a sense of, you know, what that might mean and where it might go. But I would be very concerned, you know, that it's yet another strike against an important industry that is really a critical element of our democracy, right? And I think, you know, sports journalism is an interesting canary in the coal mine here because, you know, it is the focus of a lot of people's attention in media, right? A lot of people go directly to the sports page when they buy a print newspaper. Yeah, I think we need to be very thoughtful about that for sure.
I wonder if we could come up with some subcategories under AI as we sort of continue to work with this. Cause like we mentioned tonight, like pretty much, you know, with the exception of like maybe one thing, these are all AI related. Did I put the foreign policy one about the bioweapon in there or would that have been your article? I guess I should look for the semicolon.
That is your article.
Sorry. I think I did. Okay. So, cause some of these things, I think that we need some articles that are going to not be sort of the expectation, but guardrail articles, yeah. This would fit inside that category. Ooh, guess what? We could ask ChatGPT. We could copy and paste all the AI articles we've had in the last 10 weeks and say, can you please categorize these?
That's a great idea.
In four or five categories. Okay. So this one is foreign affairs and this is November 5th. And the headline is, can chatbots help you build a bioweapon? Artificial intelligence can help it users engineer pathogens, but that's not the real danger. And the real danger, I think they're going to talk about, it's been a while since I read this. Yeah, biochemistry and, you know, basically cellular manipulation and being able to, you know, change proteins and, you know, genetics and basically that you're going to be, people are able to Frankenstein stuff now, but the capabilities of homegrown biochemists who are going to do all kinds of things like a lot of other things. I mean, you know, it's not just YouTube. It's now AI that's going to be able to help you do this. I know you did the one, the Atlantic spy, cause I didn't do this one. AI's spicy mayo problem.
Yeah, that, I thank you for driving that. So, so here's the crux of that article, is that it's talking about how there's a really delicate balance between the guardrails we're putting on AI and AI functionality. And spicy mayo refers to some people have gone, it's an interesting thought exercise, have gone to one of these large language models and asked it for a recipe for a spicy mayo that they said wasn't like an uncomfortably spicy mayonnaise, right? And the chatbot pushed back on that, or some of the chatbots pushed back on that because that's dangerous, right? You don't want a dangerously spicy mayo, which, you know, I would agree with. You do not want dangerously spicy mayo.
Hey, I've had friends play with, you know, peppers, like ghost peppers.
Oh, yeah.
Those things are not, in fact, yeah, we had somebody who brought some to school and we had a teacher who got some, passed it around with his kids. Thankfully he was in a science classroom that had the eyewash, but anyway, kids had to do the eyewash. You don't play around with ghost peppers, folks.
No, no. And I wouldn't play around with a real spicy mayo either for that matter. Right. So, the reason the metaphor that this stands for is the fact that, you know, most of these models keep adding more and more protections into the model itself. And I run into this pretty frequently. I'll give you an example of this. I was using ChatGPT the other day to write a parody of I Walk the Line, but I wanted it about my dog Lou. And so it was basically an I Walk the Line for my dog Lou.
Can it sing it like Johnny Cash too?
It didn't, although I did. So when I was, you know, testing the lyrics out. So it comes from an old joke between my wife and I, where one day I was feeding the dog and I believe that I impromptu saying, you know, because Lou's mine, I buy the Iams was my contribution to that. So, What was interesting about that was that it started generating, and about halfway through, it stopped. And it said, oh, I think I'm violating, you know, my own rules here. And so I had to do it again, because I've never had it stop in the middle of anything, right? That's a new phenomenon for me. But so I went ahead and exactly that. I tried it again, and it stopped in the middle again. And so I asked it to write a parody of I Walk the Line about my dog Lou, and it also stopped. And so I said, listen, ChatGPT, I believe that parodies are protected by your rules. Can you explain to me how this violates your rules? And it said, yeah, you're right. A parody, especially a fun parody, its word, about your dog Lou would be something that I should be able to generate. And so I said, well, please do that then. And then it stopped. So I did put in a support ticket with ChatGPT, because they ask you to report things where its model won't let you do something that it's expecting you to do. But the point of this article is that, you know, there's a middle ground, because, you know, unlimited models can do anything. Right. And they, you know, and you may do something spicy with that. But the bottom line is that you're never going to get pushback in an unlimited model. But a limited model is safer, but it's less functional. And so, you know, where will we go with that? And the article also goes into some depth about a lot of people have been concerned about the open source model from Meta. It's called Llama 2. I played with it myself. If you're a Poe user, you can go utilize the model there, because they have an implementation of the Llama 2 model. And the bottom line is that anyone can download that and create an implementation of it. In fact, that's what's going on in the background of my computer right now, is that I'm using a tool I'll talk about at the end of the show today, where you can download different models and run them locally on your computer. But the one I want to download, because I'm curious how it works, is the kind of uncensored model. And so that to me is very interesting. The other piece too is that if you don't think that students, you know, won't find their way of doing it, I don't think this is a justification for you know, not having thoughtful policies in schools. But we need to be very thoughtful about this, because if I can download it, and yeah, I'm maybe a little extra nerdy, there's a nerdy kid out there that's already running their own localized large language models. And, you know, you can run it on an M1 laptop. So it's not like you need extensive hardware to do it.
Wow. Have you had enough experiences with these to know, are they on I'm sure they're not on the level of ChatGPT-4, but are they on a 3.5 level, a Bard level? What
can you say? I have not played around enough of them to know that, but I would say it's really obvious that I can't say that they're universally deficient of 3.5's level, but it's clear it's a little more raw.
Isn't that a crazy idea that you're going to be able to download this piece of code that is basically going to be able to act in an intelligent way? I mean, that's going to be able to respond and that's without connecting to other supercomputers. I mean, that's just running on your local processor. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's crazy to me.
Yeah.
Because part of my vision and what I use in my imagination, like every time I'm, you know, asking for, you know, a query or a picture or something from ChatGPT, I'm envisioning like hundreds or thousands of computers, right, all working. But
yeah,
I don't know.
Well, and yeah, this has been going on in the background with, again, that tool. The one I downloaded is called the Bloke, uncensored Bloke, whatever the heck that means. As it turns out, it was 13 gigs. So it's been slowly downloading in the background from Hugging Face. And it's 13 gigs, right? So and the program I'm using, which again I'll talk about a little bit later, is tuned for the M1 MacBook, right? So, and I happen to have an M1 Mac Mini, so you know it's definitely got the girth to be able to handle that. And again, I don't know how fast they are yet. I have seen some evaluation of the output. But, you know, even blocking on the internet, it's not going to matter. If you have a kid sitting in the back of the classroom, has his own personal Macintosh, or a decent Windows machine, which it works on as well, you'll be able to run a local model.
And this is one of the fundamental differences between the race for AI and the struggle to try to control it and regulate it. And let's say, you know, nuclear weapons. I don't know if it was Stephen Johnson or someone else that, you know, I heard remark, hey, it's really a great thing that, you know, refined uranium isn't something you can just go into your backyard and dig up. You know, the level of infrastructure and the money that you have in order to be able to acquire those materials. Like different people, I guess, know how to make nuclear weapons, but to get the raw materials to actually do it, you know, it's really hard to do that. What's happening with AI now is you have these large companies like OpenAI and Microsoft and Google and Amazon, everybody. But then you've got open source folks and people who are saying these shouldn't be just controlled by the few big tech folks. And I kind of think I read some articles about, you know, Sam Altman and the ouster and the reinstatement and all of that. And some of them were basically commenting about how few folks were involved in those decisions. And it really kind of highlighted the power that these individuals have, they were saying, over the future. But the open source models and the uncensored things that you're talking about here, they're outside the purview at this point of anyone. And I don't really see how that kind of code would get sort of reined in. It seems like these models are going to continue to be out there, quote, in the wild. And yeah. So even if you have, and I know that President Biden had some executive orders and some statements and people are wringing their hands that Congress hasn't acted. But like, what are you expecting Congress to do? I mean, when these tools are open source, like, is someone going to try to legislate against the release of software? I don't know. I don't know what the regulatory path for that looks like. And it just seems to me that it's just trouble ahead, right? There's going to be power and good things that we can do with these tools, but the things that we're probably going to wring our hands about the most and they're going to get the biggest headlines are going to be these, you know, exceeded the guardrails, did something bad, you know, kinds of headlines.
Yeah, totally. And also, you know, I don't want to minimize the impact of these tools on, you know, the creative arts, because it's extremely important, but we haven't really even scratched the surface yet in the dangers of what this could do for elections, what this could do for propaganda, what this could do for the extraordinary impact should we give large language models decision-making capability over life and death decisions.
Gosh.
You know, that is all, you know, something that we need to be super mindful of, and we barely scratched the surface on that stuff.
Well, hey, it's not Googling during the show. It's AI grokking. You want to talk about your categories? Because I guess ChatGPT helped you out with that already.
Yeah, so I just copy and pasted the last 10 episodes article titles, and it first wanted to argue with me about terrorism. And I said, no, actually read the question. And it did. And so the six categories it came up with was AI ethics and social impact, AI in creative industries and intellectual property, AI in business and industry, AI policy and regulation, AI technology and innovations, AI in education and academic settings. And if you think about it, it's like, well, we're an ed tech show, right? That's education. But we do talk a lot about these bigger issues. And I think these might be pretty interesting subcategories in order to, you know, direct our discussions in this content area.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. As my XSplit VCam decides to pixelate on me a little bit, it's like I'm on the Enterprise, but I'm not going to fully get to beam down to the surface. Well, okay. What else would you like to delve into? How are we doing? We're about 2/3 of the way through the show.
Yeah. So let's this story got absolutely buried by the OpenAI stuff. Anthropic announced on November 21st that Claude 2.1 has been released. And Claude 2.1, among other tweaks, has a much larger context window. The context window is now 200,000 tokens, as it's called, which translates to roughly 150,000 words or 500 pages of material. So in other words, and we've talked about Claude a couple times in the past, but it's really extraordinary because you are essentially providing training data for your engagements with the model. And so as
I talked about, it's going to get better for your queries based on what you feed it?
Well, yes, but in the same way that it, you know, you upload a document, right? So that document,
but it's still within that chat window. It's not like you're.
It is, yeah. And although I should tell you, I've done some experimentations with roll your own GPTs on both Po.com and also ChatGPT-4. So I'll talk about that here in a minute. But what's really cool about that is that, you know, you can upload, you know, large amounts of text now, right? 500 pages of material, and it will analyze it and use that to answer your questions. And so as an example, last night, I spoke with that group of pre-service social studies teachers, and we talked about, you know, AI's propensity to hallucinate is obviously, you know, troublesome, especially in an area like a history class. But if you're providing it source materials to analyze, which I think is the underrated, massively interesting functionality of these large language models, you're dealing with a lot of that hallucination. So you can go to, it's not hard to find an open source textbook of which there are zero copyright issues for you or training model issues for you to source. You know, if you wanted to write some student-based materials about the Great Depression or America's role in World War I or the Reconstruction era or I was going to say Samuel L. Jackson, but no, I mean Andrew Jackson, president of the 19th century, then you can just upload, you know, college-level textbook if you like and just rewrite those student-facing materials. I would, you know, I would cite the original book and also note that you used a text analysis model to help, you know, hone it to, you know, ninth grade reading levels. But, you know, that's an easy way to, you know, create materials from scratch that probably are a lot better than the, you know, the typical, especially if you're using a David or perhaps the wrong textbook for your age of student. You know, that's a real way to develop those materials from scratch. So that huge context window is awesome.
And as platforms, we're using Canvas now as our learning management system, we'll share the, you know, import, like, I wonder when they'll do this even as a query, like, hey, if you want to import and maybe this is out there, a quiz into Canvas, here's the syntax to just go ahead and feed to the AI model, right? Because that prompt, I mean, I'm doing sort of that with a rubric and I've got a, I think both of us have sort of canned prompts sometimes that we'll repeat and you've used it and it works. So what's the canned prompt to, you know, create a quiz that is in, you know, Blukit or whatever, these different, you know, a Quizlet or these different kinds of things, or to put it in Canvas. I know that with Moodle, you all have been really big into Moodle, but like the fact that those were open source and Squirm and all that sort of stuff. But isn't it crazy to think about being able to use plain language and saying, hey, I'd like a Squirm compliant quiz and here's the chapter, write the questions. You know, generate the, you know, and by the way, let's make this on the, you know, eighth grade reading level or whatever.
Right. Well, I did that earlier this year. There's a plain text format that's called the GIFT format, G-I-F-T, which you can write in a word processor, a quiz that easily imports into Moodle. And so, I did that as an experiment one day. I copy and pasted a chapter from a textbook. I said, please write 20 multiple choice questions with a full key, including justifications for why the answer was right or why the answer was wrong, which is a time consuming but cool feature in Moodle quizzes. And then I gave it a document on how to write GIFT, and then it converted to GIFT. And so all I had to do was copy and paste the results into a text document and then upload it, and magically there it was.
I think one of the categories of articles, and there's probably a book in this, like a number of people like to, sometimes you like to hear things that reinforce your worldview.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that I frequently notice that people will, you know, they'll share. One of my students, one of my eighth graders today, told me that they had plugged in regular word problems into, you know, ChatGPT, and it got every one of them wrong. And it was this, you know, kind of story that people will tell about, well, but it really sucks. It really can't do things right. Anyway, and I don't know. There are going to be psychology words to describe that sort of thing, but you know, it can be reassuring to hear things that reinforce your existing worldview and don't challenge it. And one of those is, it's just a fill in the blank model. All it does is guess your next word. It really doesn't do anything else besides that. It's really simple. And it's like, have you played with it much? Cool. Poe, how would you put, I hadn't, and by the way, it's poe.com. How is your use of Poe fit into Claude and ChatGPT and these other tools?
Hold on one second, Wes. I did something stupid. In the background here, I had that AI model thing running. My computer just slowed down dramatically, and I'm losing video, and it's because I'm an idiot. And I so
your video just came back. Yeah, you're you know, basically mining Bitcoin right now to be become a millionaire, and it's impacting the show.
So yeah, that's weird. So Poe.com. Have I not talked about Poe.com?
You probably have, but I hadn't actually like, I don't think, brought it up on my screen and been like, oh, that's interesting.
Poe.com is wild because, and I underestimated what it could do. It can do a lot of cool things, and I underestimated what it can do. But Poe.com is a, it's kind of like, it's, I think, referred to as like a developer's platform for, you know, a large language models. But Poe.com costs $20 a month, and it gives you access to advanced ChatGPT, advanced Claude 2, the advanced versions of those, right? But it's
so
also
instead of paying directly to OpenAI ChatGPT, you pay Poe and you have access to it.
That's exactly it, right? And so, I'm just looking at the standard models, and that's all I thought this thing was, right? So, it has its own assistant. It's rolled up. It's ChatGPT 4, DALL-E 3, an older version of Claude, a newer version of Claude, a finely tuned Stable Diffusion access.
This is Metacrawler for generative AI.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it is, right? And we just lost half of our audience because we're old. But it also
what was Metacrawler, Dr. Neifer?
Well, Metacrawler back in the day was early search engines in the 1990s, like WebCrawler is an example of one, and AltaVista and Ask Jeeves and other search engines in the early days. Were, you know, what we had, but oftentimes were limited in their scope. They didn't have a Google or even a Bing back then. And so Metacrawler searched all the search engines at once and gave you aggregated results. And so, yes, as it turns out, this is the Metacrawler of the AI era, but it not only has all of those bots in it, it also has several Llama 2 bots that are easily accessible. So I've been advising, you know, the nerd set, and in fact, a couple of folks I deal with at work, you know, are buying the deal with, work with at work, dealing with, it's weird to say that, but, I have talked to them about, this as kind of a, you know, money saver, right? So you get access to advanced versions of all these without, for just $20 a month. So, but it also has the ability to create your own bots. And so what I did over the weekend, actually, it's not true. I did this last week during vacation, was that I created the Knife email bot. And so what I did was, you can choose a bot that's the core of it, right? So I I chose ChatGPT 4 as my base bot. And then I added two documents. And the first document was a 25-page document that was full of my emails, I emails I wrote from scratch. And, you know, perhaps this sounds cocky, but I am a pretty good emailer. I write a good email, especially when I'm doing like a staff announcement email, or, you know, there's a certain style or tone that comes with it. So I found my greatest hits over 5 or 6 years. It took me about a half an hour to create that 25-page document. That's my training data. And then I went and found 10 blog articles about how to write great emails, and I made that my second document. And so you can give it instructions to create a bot. And in the case of my instructions, I said, please use document number one as training data in my style of writing emails. Then please use document number two as advice on how to write quality emails. And so I can just bring up, I call it email bot 99. And I'm trying to see here. Yeah. So you are the Sharp email bot. You help me write emails in the style of my writing using the best professional advice available to craft friendly, well-written professional emails. You can do everything related to email, including writing an email from scratch, answering email, writing an email from an outline, or revisiting an email to check for tone and style. Use emailstyle.docx document to model my writing style. Use howto.docx to train on the best way to write professional emails. And then, so that's the knowledge base it goes off of. And then, when I start up the bot, it says, hi, I'm Knife Email Bot. How can I rock your email today? And so if I put in there, please write a response turning down this vendor, right, based on my style. And it's pretty close. So, you know, imagine for a moment that it's a U.S. history bot. So you have put in the textbook for your classroom and maybe the notes for your classroom. You provide your students the Dr. Knifer's U.S. history bot, so it can answer information from the materials you've shared in class. Or you've uploaded the Library of Congress strategies for primary source evaluation. And, you know, you're going to create a bot that can help students work their way through. So I want to analyze, you know, Thomas Jefferson's documents related to the separation of church and state, right? Something I dealt with all the time when I was a U.S. history teacher. You know, primary source documents, very common strategy in the more hands-on history world. So you put that up there and just walks you through how to do it. Maybe ask you questions to make that happen. And it's great. Like, but that's the same thing essentially as the roll your own GPTs that you can now do on GPT-4. And I've only played a little bit with those, but they are stunning. My favorite one is silly, but it's called the Simpsonize Me bot. And it literally, you upload a photo and it makes a Simpsons version of it, and it's great.
Did we do the weather article last time?
I don't think we did.
We'll do this one quick. We're about 8 minutes away. This was Ars Technica, November 14th. I'm fascinated by weather, by the way. Like, at one time I thought I might study it in college, and one of the reasons I declared geography was that was sort of the closest at that time at the Air Force Academy. There's so much higher level math, I don't think I would have made it. But this article says AI outperforms conventional weather forecasting for the first time in a Google study. AI models may soon enable more accurate forecasts with higher speed and lower cost. One of the things I think that's fascinating about the weather and weather prediction is that weather is chaotic and dynamical. So from my non-weather expert, you know, perspective, that means that even if you have a lot of data, like, we can't just, you know, collect more temperatures and barometric pressures in more spots in the world at more altitudes and get a guarantee that, oh, the weather prediction is going to be more accurate now because we're able to input more data. But the thing I think is probably so fascinating about this is, you know, AI's ability to look at patterns and do pattern analysis. And I think this is one of the most important things about data analytics is being able to, you know, ask questions of data, but then have novel ways of basically manipulating it to, and then trying to identify patterns and see patterns. I think now we have two main weather models. There's a European model and a North American model. And some, you know, as we were in hurricane season and they were saying, oh, this is going to, you know, sweep wide of the eastern seaboard, or no, it's not. And it just depends on which model you're going to believe or which one you're following. So this was a pretty significant article. And again, this was a Google study. And it is suggesting that, and this is from DeepMind, and they have a model called GraphCast. And so it has outperformed conventional weather forecasting for global weather conditions up to 10 days in advance. And of course, you've got the big picture, like, is it an El Nino or La Nina year? Is there going to be more snow or less overall, sort of aggregate? And then you have the really specific, like, is it going to rain here? When is it going to, right, you know, rain? When's the rain going to stop, or the snow, or whatever like that? So I thought that was fascinating. I'm really interested to continue watching this. And I think anything that involves large quantities of data is going to be a natural for AI, right? Because yep, that's how these large language models were built. It was by feeding them, you know, tons and tons of data. And to your point, the probably some of the more interesting, you know, implementations of AI are going to involve unique data sets, specific data sets. You're giving the example of your own writing and saying, hey, write based on this, you know, the weather, or you think about lawyers and what was it, LexisNexis, and all the body of case law, right? You know, if the model is trained to go off this case law, maybe lawyers aren't going to have situations like we talked about a month or so ago where, you know, a lawyer didn't realize hallucination happened and ended up, you know, trying to reference court cases and things like that that had happened before. So I thought that was pretty cool about weather, and I want to continue to follow that. And that's obviously something too that is a high interest thing to a lot of people, right? How many of us, you know, when you're going to watch, turn on the television, you're turning it on to watch the weather.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to pick up before we geek of the week?
Yeah, I think you added this article, but I've seen a couple of the references to it. Ars Technica reported on November 15th that YouTube is now asking, or I'm sorry, telling creators that they must disclose AI on their videos. And you want to take that?
Sure. So this is a big question about how YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, all these social media platforms are going to handle this idea of synthetic real media, as it's termed here. And this is a really interesting approach. Now, we've talked about deepfakes, voice cloning, disinformation. It's basically saying we've had policies that prohibit technically manipulated content that misleads viewers. However, AI, this is a quote from Google. However, AI's powerful new forms of storytelling can also be used to generate content that has the potential to mislead viewers, particularly if they're unaware the video has been altered or is synthetically created. And so this, I hadn't heard of this before. YouTube has its own generative AI products, such as the AI-powered video creator Dream Screen. I hadn't heard of that at all. When you use Dream Screen, it's going to automatically label the video as altered or synthetic. And we've talked about this idea of a watermark on images and things. And if there was a standard where, you know, things would automatically be watermarked, oh, that was created by AI. If you use an AI tool and you fail to disclose, you could be subject to penalties. And so there's not any kind of like pretending they're going to be able to detect all this. This is just basically putting it on the creator to, disclose it. And so it's going to be interesting to see how this is basically enforced. It seems, and this is, I think I have a podcast, I listen to a podcast and I don't have in the show notes. Let me see why I can pull it up on Mastodon. But they were basically saying they thought this was kind of a cop out because, you know, it's just YouTube basically saying, hey, if you're using AI tools, you know, you better tell us. And, you know, are people going to, and is this really going to be enforced? The podcast that talked about this, I may not be able to find it. Here it is. Nope. Sorry. I've got too much stuff about Aztecs. I can't find it. yeah, it was interesting to hear about this being a cop-out. What do you think? Do you think this is a good move by Google and we're going to... Oh, here it was. Decentralizing innovation with Tech Dirt's Mike Masnick dot social. That was the podcast. I'll put a link to that in.
Yeah, so I guess here's my thought on that. I do think we should be disclosing when we use AI in these pieces, but here's the problem though. Like, those solutions seem to suggest that there is that your content is either AI generated or it's not, right? That there's a binary here, and I don't think there is. In my own experience with these tools is that, I usually use a slideshow when I speak. I am a bit of a presentation slide nerd, and I, you know, I don't read off my slides, and I also don't, tend to be a presentation zen, a student, and so I try to create a certain look there. But the bottom line is that I have been, you know, working on a slideshow that I've given dozens of times over the last 12 months, and some of the images are AI generated, right? In part because there just was no way to create the exact image I was looking for. I'm also not an artist. And what I have found, as it turns out, is that I don't think that is an AI generated presentation. That is a JSON created presentation with some AI sprinkled in. Now, what I do is I add a little icon that I actually talk about at the beginning of my presentations, noting when something is AI generated, right? So that I'm doing full disclosure. But I guess that falls in my category of, you know, that's an easy answer that I'm not entirely sure is all that illustrative of what's really going on.
Well, the thing that occurs to me is it seems a bit naive, almost like a marketplace of ideas assumption about, you know, democratic ideas like, hey, the marketplace will just sort it all out and it'll become perfect because, oh, somebody's going to see that's AI generated. So I'm not going to allow my brain to be tricked by it. It reminds me of, I think we talked about some articles and some of these are in China and other places where there have been these AI companion bots. And even though people know this is not real, like sometimes people don't care. And so I kind of think that same thing will happen with content that, you know, if it's a channel that people enjoy and it's maybe it's reinforcing their worldview or whatever. I mean, it's something that they enjoy. They may not care. So it's sort of, I kind of think it does. Yes, let's do this. Let's try to attribute, just as academics do, let's attribute when we're using AI. But to think that that's going to somehow fix deepfakes or it's going to cure us of misinformation because, oh, I'll know that's AI generated. No, I don't think so. And your point is so salient that, you know, what is collaboration? What is, you know, what is cheating? If I ask you to give me feedback on my topic or my outline, have I suddenly cheated? If I do that with AIs, does my whole project become an AI generated work? Yeah, I think that's not a good analysis. So
yeah,
believe it or not, Dr. Knifer, we have gone over the top of the hour. So we probably should geek of the week it.
Sure. Well, I'll do mine quick because it's kind of silly. And it also just took down my machine a couple months ago. I am experimenting now with local AI bots that you don't need internet access for. You can't download ChatGPT locally, right? That's not what we're talking about here. But you can download a lot of the interesting models from Hugging Face. And so it's called LM Studio. And I believe it's lmstudio.ai is the web address. And again, it's an interesting piece of software. I'll be experimenting and reporting back.
Wow. Okay. I went ahead and just put in two. One of them is I have left Twitter. In fact, ladies and gentlemen, this is a historic podcast episode because we did indeed exchange without me publicly sharing it, which I was a little scared about, the link to this StreamYard using Mastodon. So probably last week, I guess, over the break, I decided to finally, you know, cut the cable. And my post is called Meet Me on Mastodon, My Dear John Letter to Twitter. So I wrote this and then I put it into AI to see if it would like, oh, rhyme this for me or whatever. And I liked my own writing better. So I didn't go with that. So this was not AI amplified or, you know, enhanced in any way. And then the other thing, this is so exciting. As anyone who's probably listened to the show knows, I'm a big media literacy advocate and consider that to be my bandwagon and my Mardi Gras float. There's the 17th annual Media Ed Forum, which is formerly the Northeast Media Literacy Conference. And it's taking place Friday and Saturday, January 12th and 13th. That is Friday and Saturday, 2024, only $25 to register. Super excited to get to participate. And then overall, that is a link to the Media Education Lab. And on Monday, they had a couple of Zoom calls and they've really rebooted the entire site. I'll share this next week, but I'm going to teach a 6-week course that's going to be on teaching the conspiracies through them. And this is just a fantastic group that is international in scope. If you have any interest at all in media literacy, you need to know about the Media Education Lab. And hey, for $25, a Zoom conference. Sounds pretty great. And that's coming up in January.
Awesome. Well, Wes, the answer to this has changed as well. Where can people find you on the internet?
Not on the Bird site. So just go to westfire.com/after. I am almost every week now publishing a Substack newsletter that I'm calling a Media Literacy Roundup. Mastodon is my social media platform of choice, but I am cross-posting to multiple places. How about you, Dr. Knife?
Well, I'm about ready to leave the Bird site as well, I think, especially since the Dr. Fryer isn't there anymore. But the probably best place to find me is LinkedIn, just to search for Jason Knifer, and there I am. This here is the EdX Situation Room. We are a once-a-week podcast on Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, sometime in the middle of the night UTC. Please join us live. In fact, that's the best way to see us right now, is to join us live. All of our archive podcasts are on YouTube and on Facebook, we are right now not publishing a podcast feed, right? Is that correct? Because the website's
yes,
down?
Yes. I may even experiment with YouTube and what that looks like, because YouTube, I mean, it may be pretty easy to just flip a switch and make YouTube the podcast feed. But anyway, yeah, it's, you go to Facebook or YouTube right now to get the latest episodes. I think that 272 is the last show or whatever. And I need to get off my duff and get some podcasts republished from not having a backup for WordPress.
There you go. So in the meantime, find us on YouTube or Facebook, and we hope to see you next time live on the EdX Situation Room. Good night.
Good night.